You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to the Explorers Podcast. I hope you are doing well. Today we wrap up the second voyage of the Astrolabe, as well as our series on Jules Dumont d'Urville. I never expected this series to go for 7 episodes, but I think it just demonstrates how much d'Urville did in his lifetime. You don't realize it until you start actually writing the stuff down. And that acknowledgement should really be a nod to Edward Diker, who wrote the book Dumont d'Urville, Explorer and Polymath. This book was just incredible for me. I could not have asked for a more thoroughly researched biography. It made for so much great material. Anyhow, we have 3 notes for today. Note number 1 is about the route of the Astrolabe and the Zealy. For that, there is a map on the website explorerspodcast.com. Note number 2 is about our giveaway of the book Daring French Explorations by Hubert Sagnier. I am extending the sign-up period for this free giveaway into mid-May, so more people have time to listen to the series and get to the site and sign up. Details are on the website, or you can look in the show notes for a link to the giveaway. Even after the giveaway is done, I will leave the site up so people can learn more about the book and see photos. And note number 3 is regarding d'Urville's wife. I have called her Adelaide throughout the series, but in reality, it should be Adelie. Not a big deal, but I wanted to correct it while I had the chance. So that is it for notes. Let's get going on the final episode in our series on Jules Dumont d'Urville. Last time, we left d'Urville as his 2 ships departed Tasmania for Antarctica, which was about 1,500 miles away, or 2,500 kilometers. Over the previous months, the expedition had endured numerous deaths, including 2 of its officers. Most of this was from dysentery. About 12 men had been recruited in Hobart, many of these deserters from other ships, as well as escaped convicts. It wasn't ideal, but at this point, d'Urville could not be picky. Now, 2 notes I want to mention about the expedition. First, d'Urville knew that in Sydney, Australia, there was a 7-ship American exploration expedition under the command of Charles Wilkes. Some or all of these ships would be leaving for Antarctica if they had not already done so. This gave d'Urville a sense of urgency as he didn't want the Americans to beat him to the area he was likely heading towards. Second note, d'Urville had a few goals for this leg of the journey. He wanted to reach the South Magnetic Pole, which had never been achieved. Also, he would love to set foot on the Antarctic continent. Again, no one had ever done that. And finally, he wanted to go as far south as possible, hopefully beating his further south mark from the previous year. And so off went the Astrolabe and the Zealy. And if d'Urville was hoping the crew's health issues were behind him, he was wrong. Within 4 days, 9 men had dysentery. These were mostly relapse cases. A sign d'Urville had pushed some of the men back into service too quickly. The expedition could only give these sailors as few duties as possible to alleviate the stress and strain of their condition. The Zealy would have 1 man die on January 11th, but thankfully the dysentery cases subsided as the ships moved further south. On January 15th, 1840, floating ice was sighted. The next day there were icebergs 40 meters, or a quarter of a mile, wide. Despite the appearance of ice, the temperatures were moderate for this time of year. On the evening of January 18th, the expedition was greeted by heavy snow. The next morning, d'Urville counted 16 floating islands of ice. By that evening, there were 60 of them. Some were more than a kilometer, or half a mile, wide. Also, the men saw petrels, which are big seabirds, plus penguins and seals. That was, hopefully, a sign that land was nearby. That same day, the ships crossed the Antarctic Circle. This location is not fixed, but it was probably around 66 degrees south. That meant Derville had gone past their furthest south mark from the previous year in the Weddell Sea, which had been 64 degrees 23 minutes south. By the way, since the ship crossed the Antarctic Circle, Derville let his men treat it like an equator crossing. This meant breaking out food and drink and having a bit of a party, although not quite as hardcore as crossing the equator. For obvious reasons, no one was dunked into the ocean. Instead, each crewman was showered with dry beans and rice and given ceremonial wine. Derville, who was never big on this sort of thing, volunteered to be the first man to go through the ceremony. On January 20th, at midday, the ship sighted land. The Antarctic coast was nothing but a wall of snow and ice, and the waters were choked with icebergs, floes, and islands. Derville ordered his ships into the maze. It was an extraordinary sight. Derville wrote this of the ice, quote, "The sheer walls were far higher than our masts. They overhung our ships, the size of which seemed ridiculously small in comparison with the enormous masses. The spectacle they presented was both grand and overawing. One could have believed oneself in the narrow streets of a city of giants." End quote. As the ships moved amongst the great bergs and ice islands, it was an experience unlike any other. The walls of the icebergs were so immense, they would block the sun so completely, it was like night. Derville said that going through the ice had an almost magical effect, distorting light and shadows in the size of things. There were also the echoes and sounds of the polar world, bellowing seals and screeching petrels and the low rumbling thunder of ice crashing together, almost in slow motion. Another emotion it conjured was fear. Derville wrote this passage about the enormity of the ice. Quote, "When our eyes turned towards the Zelie, which followed us a short distance behind, she appeared so tiny, her rigging so frail, that we were unable to suppress a feeling of terror." End quote. I love all of these lines. It's awe-inspiring in so many ways, and it scared the crap out of the men as well. One mistake, and they were dead. Anyhow, it was not long after this that Ensign Joseph Antoine Duroc of the Astrolabe spotted rocks, not ice, but rocks, with a telescope, on one of the islands along the coast. Both the Astrolabe and the Zelie would thus launch one of their small boats to investigate this sighting of actual land. The Astrolabe's yawl, under the command of Ensign Duroc, would reach the island first. This specific island was dubbed Rocher du Debarquement, or Debarquement Rock. It's a tiny place, just 650 feet wide, or 200 meters, but it is free of ice. Thus, Duroc and his men, using picks and hammers, gathered geological samples, shooing away penguins who were curious about these strange creatures they had never seen before. While Duroc's men gathered rocks, the Zelie's men, led by Joseph Dubuisset, went to the top of the island, which was only about 60 feet high, and raised a French flag, and took formal possession of the area for France. The men had even brought a bottle of Bordeaux, which they drank to conclude the ceremony. Of it, Dubuisset wrote, quote, "We had added a province to French territory through this entirely peaceful conquest," end quote. A few notes about the first French landing in Antarctica, which lasted all of about a half hour. 1. The men found no plant specimens on the island except for a single piece of dry seaweed. 2. From the island, the men were about 5 to 600 meters, or about a third of a mile, from the Antarctic coast. They could see exposed land, mainly the summits of various mountains. Otherwise, before them was a great glacier, which today is called the Astrolabe Glacier. There was no obvious way to approach the actual continent, as it was all blocked by ice. 3. When the boats had landed on the little island, one of the men, Midshipman Jean-Edmond Gaillard of the Zelie, had fallen into the water while debarking. He would get hypothermia and develop a respiratory infection. Sadly, he would never recover from it and die on the voyage back to France. And finally, Derville had actually discovered a section of Antarctica. What would he name it? Perhaps he could name it after the king, or maybe some bigwig at the Navy, or even himself. Well, it was a no to all of those. This section of the coast was dubbed Adélie Land, after his wife. It is the name that the world calls it to this day. In fact, this section of Antarctica is still claimed by France because of what Derville and his men did nearly 200 years ago. Also, in 1956, the French constructed a research facility on nearby Petrel Island. The facility is the Dumont-Durville Station, and it still exists today. By the way, there would be other naming of places by Derville. There's Cape Jules for his son, Cape Pepin for his wife's family. Other spots were named after members of the crew. The one name that most people will be familiar with is the Adélie Penguin, again named after his wife, which can be found all over the Antarctic coast. The expedition was the first to bring specimens of the penguin back to Europe. And with that, Derville and the expedition headed west, looking for a way to get closer to the continent. Unfortunately, ice blocked them whenever they tried to move to the coast. and it wasn't long before gales and squalls were whipping around the ships, covering them in ice and snow. It was incredibly dangerous. I want to mention this one situation because it was so amazing and scary. So the snow and water were whipping around the Astrolabe, hitting it on one side and immediately freezing. This caused the ship to start tipping over. It was so severe, a side of the ship became submerged in the water almost completely, reaching all the way to the gunwales, which is the upper edge of the ship. The Astrolabe was in danger of essentially tipping on its side. If that happened, water would be free to pour in, and the ship would be lost. Thankfully, it never came to that as the weather cleared and the ship righted itself. The bad weather exhausted the men of both ships, but Derville was, rightfully, proud of how they had responded to the challenge they had faced. It was a testament to the growth of the men, as well as Derville's leadership skills. Derville continued his journey west. One of his goals was to reach the magnetic South Pole, but the closer they got to it, the wackier their instruments became. At one point, Derville checked his compass, and the needle just spun round and round and round. Reaching the South Magnetic Pole was not in the cards. It would not actually be accomplished until January of 1909, when members of Ernest Shackleton's Nimrod expedition reached the location. In late January, the two ships were separated by the weather and forced to fire their cannons to try and signal each other. They would eventually get back together on January 25th. The next day, they found themselves amongst a sea of ice. 150 icebergs were counted. Derville continued to weave through the ice and even pushed through it at times, looking for a way to the south and the continent. The combination of heavy snow, rough and churning waters, ice and fog made the going difficult. And then on January 28th, the expedition would have an encounter that they were not expecting, another ship. This was the Porpoise, under the command of Cadwallader Ringgold of the United States Exploring Expedition Squadron. It was one of the seven ships that was part of the expedition. What followed next would generate some controversy. Both sides signaled the other, and Derville slowed up, the idea to let the American vessel come alongside him and get within hailing distance. But instead of doing so, the Porpoise veered off and away from the Astrolabe. The American commander would later say that he had taken Derville's actions as a signal that he didn't want to have any interactions. Each side seems to have blamed the other for the miscommunication. But in reality, I'm guessing neither side was thrilled to see the other. They were, after all, rivals. The last thing they wanted was to reveal to one another what they had been up to. The main takeaway was that Derville now knew that the Americans were in the vicinity, specifically to the west, where he was exploring. He didn't really want to cover territory that had already been investigated by the Americans. With the Americans poking around in the west and his men exhausted, Derville decided any further attempts to reach the Antarctic coast were fruitless. And so on February 7th, he ordered his ships north. 10 days later, they arrived in Hobart in Tasmania. Derville's excursion to Antarctica was over. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED lights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Hey, explorers, it's Matt. What if you could poke, prod, and explore the mysteries of nature from wherever you are? Outside In is the award-winning podcast from New Hampshire Public Radio that allows you to do just that. From explorations of nature to important conversations about climate change and sustainability, award-winning reporter and host Nate Hedgie covers all kinds of topics related to our world. They cover fascinating topics like the wild horses of the American West and why they are so divisive, little-known tales from the world of competitive dog sled racing, and the disappearing dunes of coastal Oregon that inspired the desert planet of Arrakis. Through in-depth reporting and narrative storytelling, Outside In meets listeners wherever they are to take them on the journey. It's not just for thru-hikers and conservationists. It is a podcast for anyone who is curious about the natural world. Listen to new episodes every Thursday wherever you get your podcasts. In Hobart, the French took the time to recover and repair their ships, especially the masts and the rigging, which had been damaged by the ice. Sadly, two crewmen who had gotten sick on the Antarctic excursion would be hospitalized and later die. but Derville would have no problem filling out the crews of his ships. He counted 13 French whaling vessels in Hobart's harbor on his arrival, plus there were the usual convicts looking for a way out of Australia. By the way, the whaling industry was shifting from South America to Australia and New Zealand due to the overhunting of whales in the former area. Derville would visit with Sir John Franklin and his wife, updating him on where he had been and what he had found. For all he had done, Derville was elected a member of the Tasmanian Natural History Society, which he took great pride in. The expedition departed Hobart on February 25, 1840. They sailed east across the Tasman Sea, reaching the Auckland Islands on March 11th. These islands are about 300 miles or 480 kilometers south of New Zealand. No one lived there due to the harsh conditions. The islands were mostly used by sealers and whalers. The French surveyed the islands and did magnetic observations. The team would also make a discovery, a new sea duck unknown to science, the Auckland Island merganser, which is, sadly, now extinct. By the way, the highest peak on the island is now called Mount Derville. The expedition spent 9 days in the Auckland Islands before heading north. A few days later, the southern tip of New Zealand was spotted. For this part of the voyage, Derville elected to go up the eastern side of the South Island, which he had not done before. On March 30th, he reached Otago Harbor, where he found numerous vessels, including whalers from England, America, and France. There was a community of Europeans at Otago Harbor, which Joseph Dubuzet described as consisting of deserters and escaped convicts. Alcohol abuse and prostitution were rampant. The relations between the Europeans and the Maori were tense. The latter had abandoned many of their customs and were described as greedy and debased, as wives and children were forced into prostitution. The expedition took on supplies, then continued up the coast on April 3rd. 5 days later, they reached Akaroa on the Banks Peninsula. Akaroa had a beautiful harbor, a flooded volcanic crater. Here, Derville found several French whalers. And it was here that he also learned about the Treaty of Waitangi, which had been signed a couple of months earlier. Let me explain what that is and what it meant. The Treaty of Waitangi was first signed on February 6, 1840, by Captain William Hobson as counsel for the British Crown and roughly 40 Maori chiefs from the North Island of New Zealand. The treaty was then taken around New Zealand, including the South Island, getting more than 500 signatures. Now, the ramifications and ethics of the treaty aside, that's for an entirely different podcast, the treaty was the basis for Great Britain claiming sovereignty over all of New Zealand. Derville was not thrilled by this declaration, but he saw it as inevitable. British trading posts and missionaries were too embedded throughout New Zealand for anyone, including the French, to try and make any sort of claim. Derville knew that an isolated colony would be overwhelmed by the British in any conflict. It was foolish to consider such a thing in New Zealand or Australia. Now, despite this, that doesn't mean that someone from France didn't try and set up a colony in New Zealand. Derville didn't know it, but as he departed Akaroa, a ship was on the way to that very spot bearing 63 French colonists. This enterprise was courtesy of a man named Jean-François Langlois, who had cut some shady deals with a variety of Maori chiefs, supposedly giving him ownership of the area. These colonists would arrive in Akaroa later in 1840, only to find a British warship waiting for them. They were allowed to disembark and set up their little colony, but it would be under the auspices of Great Britain, not France. By the way, the little settlement would survive and thrive, and even today retains a French flavor. The expedition departed the area on April 17th, going first to Poverty Bay and then on to the Bay of Islands at the northern tip of New Zealand. At each location, Derville found British warships preparing to enforce their claim on New Zealand. Derville, by the way, refused to go along with the British claims, and everywhere he went, he refused to acknowledge Hobson as the first governor of the islands. Anyhow, at the Bay of Islands, the expedition prepared to set sail on what was essentially a long voyage home. Derville's plan was to go through the Torres Strait, running between New Guinea and Australia, and then across the Indian Ocean, around Africa, and then home to Europe. By the way, it was at this time that Derville got his first taste of New Zealand wine. He thought it was delicious and predicted it would soon be exported. He nailed that one. The ships would do necessary repairs and take on supplies for their journey. One interesting note I'll pass on before we leave New Zealand details the fate of one-time deserter Charles Simone. The man had been captured in Vavahu, and Derville had taken him back on the Astrolabe, and he had performed his duties well. Before departing New Zealand, a local French priest came to Derville and asked him to allow Simone to remain. France was no longer the man's home. He had a wife and children on Vavahu, and the priest praised Simonet for the work he had done to support the Catholic clergy when they had tried to set up a church on the island. Derville would agree. He allowed Simonet to disembark and even gave him wages for the time served on this recent voyage. I've mentioned this before, but Derville doesn't seem to have been a vengeful man, and this demonstrates that fact. By the way, Simonet would ultimately move to Uvea with his family and then Tahiti. He had at least four children and moved back to Tongatapu in 1862. A Simonet was recorded living there as recently as 1925. The Astrolabe and the Zélée departed New Zealand on May 4, 1840. The ship sailed north towards New Caledonia and then west to New Guinea. The expedition traded with the natives of New Guinea when they could, but they did not stop. By the way, Derville was suffering badly from gout, plus stomach pains, likely the result of his gout medication. On June 1st, the ships entered the Torres Strait, which, as I have said, consists of some of the trickiest waters in the world. And you know what? The two ships would find this out almost from the get-go. The Astrolabe and the Zélée entered a channel in the strait that turned out not to be a channel, but a cul-de-sac. They were soon surrounded by coral reefs in shallow waters and unable to turn around due to the winds. It wasn't long before the Astrolabe scraped against some coral and came to a stop. Soon the ship was listing to one side. The Zélée quickly followed suit. Both vessels were now stuck on coral reefs, their hulls scraping and grinding as the water jostled the ships back and forth. Derville ordered the sails furled and his anchors lowered. Unfortunately, the tide dropped and both ships were firmly captured on the reef. The Astrolabe was in a worse situation, as the constant back and forth caused the ship's false keel to tear off. Once that happened, the timber spine of the ship was resting directly on the reef with no extra protection. More anchors were dropped to further stabilize the ships. That night, gale force winds and fierce rains pounded the strait. The ships were lifted up and down and left and right on the reef. The Astrolabe was tilting so badly to one side, the spare mast was brought out and set up like a brace, trying to keep the ship from tilting further to one side. It failed. The Astrolabe was dangerously close to capsizing. High tide came, along with the hope that the ships would be freed from the reefs, but it wasn't enough. Both vessels remained stuck. Derville had items shifted in the hold to help get the ship to lean upright, but no luck. The Astrolabe tipped further and further to one side, the ocean water coming over the side of the ship and onto the deck. It was only a matter of time before water got into the hold. Everyone waited for the order to abandon ship. By the way, there is a great painting by Louis Le Breton depicting the efforts to save the Astrolabe. I put a link to it on the website. Anyhow, on June 3rd, the tides rose, allowing the Zélée to get off the reef, but not the Astrolabe. Thus, the expedition had to wait another day, and this time at high tide, with the help of the men of the Zélée and some favorable currents, the Astrolabe slid off the reef. She was now afloat. The ship had taken on a little water, but was remarkably undamaged by the incident. Derville would allow his men to rest for a couple of hours, then they had to repair the ship's rigging and get ready to sail. It would take several days to escape the dead-end channel the ships had gotten into. This is because the smaller boats led the way, slowly advancing and sounding out the depths as they went. Despite the cautious approach, the smaller boats would end up scraping their bottoms on the coral more than once. Once the ships exited the channel, they proceeded west, going slowly and carefully to avoid a repeat of the recent navigational error. The ships would pass through the Torres Strait on June 12th. One interesting note about the journey through the strait. On the island of Tudu, which is near where the Astrolabe had almost been wrecked, Derville got hold of a giant clamshell. He would end up donating the shell to the church where he was baptized to be used as a holy water font. I think it demonstrates just how close the Astrolabe was to being wrecked, that Derville, who was not a particularly religious man, would take something from the area and use it in a religious setting, a nod of thanks to a greater power who had helped them out of the perilous situation. The expedition continued west, stopping at the Dutch port of Kupang on the island of Timor on June 19th. There they took on food, water, and firewood. Next, it was on to Ternate, where the expedition had been a year before. The island had suffered an earthquake and volcanic eruption just 10 months after their visit. Some of the naturalists had even climbed the mountain which had erupted. On June 26, 1840, Derville gathered his men and officially announced the expedition was over. They were returning to France. The ship sailed west, going to the usual places on the journey back to Europe, Mauritius, Bourbon Island, and then around the Cape of Good Hope and on to St. Helena. On Bourbon, the expedition would receive mail from home. There was also official word of many promotions, and Derville handed out 20 medals. All of this helped the men's spirits. Derville also left some of the chronically sick men to recover, as the long sea voyage ahead would not be good for them. One of these men was Jean-Edmond Gaillard, a midshipman on the Zeelee. He would die 5 months later of tuberculosis. The expedition had a remarkably calm passage around the tip of Africa and then reached St. Helena on September 7th. Many of the men wanted to go visit the grave of Napoleon, but they would find that his body had been exhumed 2 months earlier. Derville had offered to do that job a decade before. Napoleon, by the way, would be reburied in Paris in a state funeral in December, 700,000 people attending the ceremony. The expedition reached the Azores on October 20th, then 11 days later passed through the Strait of Gibraltar. On November 7th, 1840, the ships entered the harbor at Toulon. The second voyage of the Astrolabe was over. The two ships had been gone for 3 years and 2 months. In Toulon, the expedition was greeted by Pierre-Antoine Delafon, the midshipman who had been sent home prior to going to Antarctica due to health issues. Derville was delighted to see that he had recovered. He would help organize the unloading of all the expedition's stuff, which allowed the other officers to get away quicker. As Toulon was the home port for the ships, word quickly spread about their arrival, and there were many happy reunions. Derville was reunited with his wife and son. Adélie had struggled over these past years and still suffered from anxiety and depression, but having her husband home was a great help. Derville was ordered to go immediately to Paris, but he would wait 2 months before doing so. Not only did he have family to attend to, his health was not good. He was in such pain he had to be helped into a carriage. A friend said he was, quote, no more than a specter, a worn body that dragged itself painfully with the aid of a humble walking stick, end quote. Derville would immediately begin a campaign to gain honors and promotions for himself and his men. Edward Dyker, in his biography on Derville, said he was, quote, relentless in his demands for the recognition of his men, end quote. Derville would be promoted to Rear Admiral on December 31st, 1840. It was said that he wept when he got the news. This was all he had ever dreamed of. He had come back to France and was hailed a great man, an explorer and scientist of the highest regard. And his men were honored as well. There were promotions and awards and knighthoods to be given out. Eventually, Derville headed to Paris to oversee the putting together of all the stuff that they had accumulated on the recent circumnavigation of the globe. The expedition had not necessarily brought home more specimens than on the previous voyage, but they had gone to more isolated areas. This meant many new and unique items. There were thousands of plants, animals, sketches, and drawings. There were more than 5,000 mineral and rock samples. And the goofy phrenology stuff, the measuring of the skull and so forth, while Pierre-Marie-Alexandre Dumonté, the phrenologist, had brought back hundreds of skulls and busts of people from all over the world, not to mention measurements, people were fascinated by it. So things were going pretty well for Derville. On March 4th, he was invited to a banquet where he was greeted and honored by King Louis Philippe. That's big stuff. He got a gold medal from the Société de Géographie de Paris and was even invited to dinner by his old commander from the Coquille, Louis-Isidore Duperrey. It is not known if he accepted the invitation from his old boss, whom he had fallen out with. Derville and his family would eventually move to Paris so he could begin putting together all the results of the expedition. By the way, these results would be published between 1841 and 1854 in a staggering 24 volumes, plus 7 more volumes of illustrations and maps. Pretty amazing. Regarding his family, Adélie's health would improve, and Derville's son, Jules, who was a teenager, was at the top of his class in subjects such as physics, chemistry, and natural history. He was a master at languages, like his father. He was destined for big things. Everything seemed pretty good, despite the physical and mental health issues for both Derville and his wife. He was famous and respected, and he was home for good. No more sea voyages. Ah, but I'm not going to lie to you. This story is not going to be a happily ever after. Let us jump to Sunday, May 8, 1842. Derville took his family, including his wife and son, by train to Versailles, where there was a big celebration honoring the king. On the return trip, the train, which included a pair of locomotives and 14 passenger cars, would experience some problems. Witnesses said they could see the wheels of the lead engine wobbling. At 7 p.m., the axle of the locomotive broke, overturning the two engines. The first 6 carriages piled into those. The fireboxes of the locomotives ignited the splintered timber of the carriages. Add in the steam from the boilers, and it turned into an inferno. To add to the nightmare, the doors to the passenger cars had been locked, so no one could escape. It was later determined that Derville and his family, along with many others, had survived the crash, but had been trapped and burned to death. Derville was identified by Dumonté, the phrenologist, who had done a bust of Derville's skull and matched it to one of the charred remains. Derville's wife and son were identified by various physical characteristics. The Versailles rail accident was the deadliest train wreck in the world at the time, with between 50 and 200 people dying in the wreck. The derailment led the French to abandon the practice of locking passengers in their carriages. By the way, the axle that had broke had been caused by metal fatigue, which was poorly understood at the time of the disaster. The wreck led to detailed research into the problem to help avoid future catastrophes. D'Urville's funeral was held with full military honors on May 12, 1842, in Paris. In attendance were 15 admirals, the Minister of the Navy, the entire Naval Officer and Hydrographic Corps, senior administrators in the French government, politicians, scientists, friends, colleagues, and members of both sides of the family. D'Urville's closest friend, Charles Jacquinot, was not at the funeral as he was not in Paris at the time. The family would be buried in Paris, despite D'Urville's wishes that they were buried in Toulon with their other children. Their graves remain there to this day. So Jules Dumont D'Urville was dead. He was 51 years old. Like with all of our explorers, let's talk about the man's accomplishments and legacy. I'll begin by mentioning some of the people related to our story. And when I say some, I really mean just one. D'Urville had 20-plus years of work as an explorer, and he dealt with many, many people. I've talked about many of them as we've gone through our story. Many of these people would go on to be successful artists, scientists, naval officers, and much more. There's really too many to go through them all. But there's one person I do want to mention, and that is Charles Jacquinot. I don't really think I give Jacquinot enough credit in our story. He was with D'Urville for 2 decades, and they were best friends. Jacquinot was the steadfast and trusted number two man, and he understood D'Urville and got along with him, not something everyone could do. It made them a great team. After the death of D'Urville, Jacquinot would be named to oversee the publication of all the information from the recent expedition. As I mentioned, it consisted of 24 volumes, plus 7 more volumes with illustrations and maps. Jacquinot would go on to rise to the rank of Vice Admiral in the French Navy and serve in the Crimean War. He died in 1879 at the age of 83, just a few months after retiring from the Navy. Now, I don't have any other people I want to talk about, but I do want to mention our ships, the Astrolabe and the Zélée. The former was such an important part of our story. The Astrolabe would serve as a naval transport for another decade after her return to France from her epic third voyage. In May of 1852, however, she was condemned and broken up. The Zélée lasted longer. It was converted to a pontoon in 1863, and then in 1877, it was used as a floating powder magazine. She was finally broken up in 1887. So as we take a look at the legacy of D'Urville, I have to admit it is, in many ways, difficult to wrap up the man in a sentence or two. And that's all right. Not everyone is defined that easily. I'll start by saying that when I began this series, I didn't know that much about D'Urville. Honestly, most people probably have never heard of the guy. I think there are a few reasons for this. First, D'Urville never really had a signature aha moment, the kind of thing that everyone remembers him or her for. Some of this, I think, is attributable to the fact that D'Urville saw himself as more than just an explorer. Many explorers find a place, stick a flag in the ground, and then go back home and crow about it to the world. D'Urville was, without question, interested in those sort of things. But more importantly, he saw his mission as uncovering the nature and essence of the places he went to. That meant mapping and charting. That meant collecting meteorological and astronomical data. That meant gathering plant and animal specimens. That meant diving into the world of the people he encountered, including their language and customs. We talked about this on the Alexander von Humboldt series. Like Humboldt, D'Urville was about seeing everything about a place, not just adding it to a map. Author Edward Diker, who wrote the definitive book on D'Urville, titled his book, Dumont D'Urville, Explorer and Polymath, and I think that defines D'Urville in so many ways. Yes, he was a sailor and explorer, but he was also a geographer, a cartographer, an ethnologist, a linguist, a naturalist, and a dabbler in so many other things. He was, in many ways, a great example of a man of the Enlightenment. In the end, D'Urville did so much, it's hard to say this is what he did. But for fun, let's just rattle off a few items. The man was a key reason that France acquired the famed Venus de Milo. Not exactly an explorer victory point, but it is pretty cool. Over 3 epic expeditions, 2 of which he led, he collected tens of thousands of plant, animal, and geological samples. The maps and charts his teams put together covered thousands and thousands of miles of lands, coasts, and oceans. It is work that is, in some places, the most accurate ever done to this day. And we can't forget about his confirmation of the fate of the La Pérouse expedition. That helped settle a long-standing mystery. And during all of this, D'Urville never lost a ship. He lost men, but never a ship. D'Urville's greatest accomplishment was probably being the first Frenchman to reach Antarctica and his exploration around Adélie Land. Sure, he discovered other islands and so forth, but nothing major. In the end, I think Derville got lost in some ways to history, especially outside of France. A big reason, I think, was that he often followed in the footsteps of others. He took earlier discoveries and pulled back the veil on these places and the people who lived there. Or when he did something that was potentially major, he was quickly overshadowed by others. He was the second person to find out about La Perouse. His explorations of the coast of Australia and New Zealand as a potential French penal colony were always quickly followed by the British, who beat the French in the colonization game. And in the case of his big discovery, Antarctica, his work was quickly overshadowed by James Clark Ross, whose Antarctic expedition in the early 1840s would uncover the southern continent way more than anyone previously, including D'Urville. That expedition marked the discovery of the Ross Sea and the Ross Ice Shelf. Another thing, D'Urville's death in 1842 prevented him from working to promote his accomplishments. Let's remember, D'Urville was not the most sociable guy. People just didn't like him that much. Once he died, he lacked a champion. It allowed people to forget all the things that he had done. Instead, they embraced the exploits of people like Ross, John Franklin, and other explorers. Personally, I find D'Urville to be a fascinating, yet at times frustrating guy. He had a very modern approach to geography. He understood why it was so critical to accurately map reefs and bays and coastlines and all these little things that most of us find inconsequential. He was a man of intellect. He demonstrated courage and leadership, especially with experience. He was known to be generous and kind. Yet he was also a jerk at times. He was blunt, which could come across as rude and arrogant. I admire that he didn't like to play the games that went on within the Navy and the government, yet frustrated by him for missing out on bigger opportunities due to his unwillingness to accept certain social norms. I also want us to remember that D'Urville was known for his own moods of melancholy and depression, and I think it's pretty amazing that he overcame those things to be so successful at what he did. Sadly, these parts of his personality would mix badly with D'Urville's health issues, and he would be this perpetually cranky and grumpy man. But you know what? That's okay. It just makes him a very real human being. So I say that D'Urville isn't that recognizable of a name in the world of exploration, but you know what? He is remembered in all sorts of ways to this day. The name D'Urville is attached to islands, capes, mountains, a peninsula, a valley, and a channel. There are many roads and schools with his name. His name appears in some form in 24 French cities and towns, as well as 5 in New Zealand and 1 in Tahiti and Australia. And remember, he named dozens, probably hundreds of places that don't necessarily have his name, but those of people he knew and served with. I mentioned a bunch of these people as we went through our story, but there are lots and lots more. Probably the most famous is Adélie Land and the Adélie Penguin. Another thing, there are 7 plants and 3 animals named after D'Urville. On a fun note, Australian Antarctic explorer Douglas Mawson named his favorite dog after D'Urville. So that is my wrap on the life of Jules Dumont D'Urville. I want to finish with a few acknowledgments. First, I cannot stress how important Edward Diker's book, Dumont D'Urville, Explorer and Polymath, was to this series. There is nothing out there that even remotely compares to Diker's comprehensive look at the life of the man. I could not have done this series without the book. One thing I want to share that I love is that in the acknowledgement section of the book, Diker mentions his mother helping him decipher D'Urville's handwritten notes. D'Urville, by the way, had horrible handwriting, almost impossible to read. And this is the depth that Diker goes to. He's translating texts that no one has ever really translated before, and it gives us insight and details into the life of D'Urville that we had never seen before. Again, it's great stuff, super detailed, probably beyond anything I've ever read on an explorer from this era. Second, I want to thank Hubert Sagnier, the author of Daring French Explorations. I never expected our giveaway to turn into such a big deal, and I never expected to interact with the man, but he ended up being really gracious. He emailed me, sending me photos and updates about his trip around the world, following in the footsteps of explorers such as D'Urville. He even gave me a call just to thank me for the work I put into the series, so that was awesome. And finally, I cannot say thank you enough to Melly, the wonderful young woman who first contacted me about promoting the Daring French Explorations book. She has been so open with collaborating on this giveaway and was an immensely enthusiastic and gracious partner. I even got to meet her when my wife and I went up to Canada last fall. And she even sent me some of her family's amazing maple syrup. And to top it off, she's helped me with all the French pronunciations, for which I am grateful. So thank you, Melly, a million times over. Otherwise, that is it for our story of French explorer Jules Dumont D'Urville. I hope you've enjoyed this series. Thank you for listening. Please take care. I will see you next time. The Explorers Podcast is part of the Airwave Media Network. For other cool shows, go to airwavemedia.com. If you are a book lover, I'll recommend What Should I Read Next? Or if you have curious kids, there's The 10 News, which is news aimed at kids.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.